All right. Got an easy memory verse this time. I hope we're getting it down, which is Exodus 13 and verse 3. And as always, I'll allow you to read it with me, because if we just try to go completely from memory, we probably stumble a little. But, and Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." And keep in mind, parents, your children will have that verse, possibly a truncated version of it next month, but they will have this next quarter. So you'll be a little bit ahead on that. Let's think about where we are tonight. You know, the story of Exodus, I guess in one sense we could say it goes all the way back to the very beginning of Genesis, but it's directly tied to the events of Genesis 11 and 12, when God calls Abram and tells him to leave the land of his fathers, leave Ur, and to make that journey to the land of Canaan, where he said of him, "I will make of you a great nation, and of ultimately that nation that I develop out of you will be given this land in which to dwell." And then he said, "And through your seed, all the nations of the earth will be blessed." I want to keep reminding us, as we go through the rest of the Old Testament, our focus is on the nation singular. Now, I know in the days of Jeroboam and Rehoboam, it'll divide into two kingdoms. But the Old Testament's the story of that nation singular that came out of Abraham. But through it all, he is looking forward to the time when all nations will be blessed. They are never forgotten. The spiritual part of the promise is never to be forgotten. And as we go through Exodus, I think we're going to see a lot of tie-ins to that spiritual promise. Well, Abraham, of course, lives in that land of Canaan along with Isaac and Jacob. But eventually, at the end of Exodus, the family has moved down into Egypt. And you remember the approximate number given when they moved into Egypt? 70. You know, some of the accounts will say 75, you know, the Septuagint. You know, as I said, a big family. I mean, that'd be a huge family reunion, but that'd be a pitiful nation. You know, that they're not a nation when the book of Genesis closes. Although, by the time Genesis ends, they would have grown some. But when the book of Exodus opens, what it opens with is the statement that they are growing rapidly. They are multiplying exceedingly. Chapter 1, verse 7, "Fruitful, increased abundantly, multiplied, grew exceedingly mighty. The land was filled with them." We're seeing the promise begin to develop. Except that the Pharaoh then becomes afraid of the people, frightened. And he oppresses them. But there's really shouldn't be any surprise in that. God had foretold that back in Genesis 15. And there in the first chapter, or the second chapter of Exodus, Moses is born. And it is amazing how quickly time moves in these first few chapters of Exodus. It starts out sometime before the birth of Moses. By the time we get to the third chapter, Moses is 80 years old. You know, we cover a lot of time in those, you know, first couple of chapters. But Moses raised his son of Pharaoh's daughter. At the age of 40, he has to flee over into Midian. And then at the age of 80, he is called to lead Israel. How does God appear to him? In the burning bush. And when he says, "Moses, you are the man. You are the one that..." Yes, Brother Paul. Okay. He said, you know, you're going to lead them out. And how excited was Moses about this job? He just kept making excuse after excuse, didn't he? I mean, I think humility would naturally prompt some of what he said. You know, in chapter 3, verse 11, who am I? I don't think there is a thing in the world wrong with that statement. That Moses would say, Lord, I don't feel qualified for this. And God said, well, I'll be with you. Well, then he says, but Lord, you know, what am I going to say when they ask me, who has sent me? What's your name? God explains his name to him. And then he says, well, but they're going to say, how do we know the Lord appeared to you? Again, that's a good question. God said, well, here are the signs. The rod becoming the serpent, the hand in the bosom becoming leprous, clean again. He said, you can pour water out on the ground, it'll be blood. And then Moses says, but I'm not a good speaker. And God says, I'm the person that makes mouths and ears and, you know, every part of your body. I know who you are. And then God's patience finally runs out when Moses said, well, just send somebody, but not me. He said, no, it's going to be you, and I'm going to give you your brother to help you, and you go. And with that, then Moses headed out to Egypt. Brother Paul. It does what God wants it to, and it is, sometimes it's a purifier. You know, sometimes they put metals through fire, but it is interesting. Look at how often fire is associated with God in sacrifice, Mount Carmel, with Elijah, the chariots of fire that came down. When God appears to Ezekiel, there'll be fire. It's going to be a common thing. All right. Now, this one mummy, I'm not saying that's the Pharaoh that Moses dealt with, but turn to chapter 5. It's where we want to pick up. Moses has come to Egypt. And I might remind you what we looked at the very end of chapter 4. These people have suffered oppression for more than 80 years. And Moses shows up, having been gone for 40 years, and he says to them, God has spoken to me. Notice verse 30 of the fourth chapter. Aaron spoke all the words that the Lord had spoken to Moses. Then he did the signs in the sight of the people. You know, the rod became the serpent. The hand would have been put into the bosom and come out. And the people believed. And verse 31 said, when they heard that the Lord had visited the children of Israel, that he had looked on their affliction, then they bowed their heads and worshiped. The word visit in the Bible commonly, most commonly, has reference to looking to the needs of somebody. Visits the orphans and widows in their affliction. God has visited his people. They're excited about this. They bow their heads in worship. But let's see how long that lasts. Moses and Aaron, chapter 5, they go into Pharaoh and said, let my people go. Notice that expression, my people. You begin to pay attention to that one. That's going to be a common phrase from here on in the book of Exodus. You let my people go that they may hold this feast. And what is the question of Pharaoh? Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Who is this Yahweh, Jehovah? The, you know, I, The pharaohs of Egypt thought of themselves as being descended from the gods. Pharaoh, the Egyptians, they believed in many gods. Pharaoh says, who is this Lord you're talking about? This Jehovah God, this Yahweh, the God of Israel. Why should I don't know him. That's what he says in verse 2. I mean, just almost imagine Pharaoh naming off a bunch of gods that he's familiar with. And he says, no, been through the list. I don't know any Jehovah, anyone called the Lord. You know, he said, I'm not going to listen to him. And they said, but no. Verse 3, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. And he said, we just want to go 3 days' journey into the desert and make sacrifice, lest he punish us. Take note of that. Verse 3, Moses and Aaron said, he may punish us with pestilence or with a sword. And so, what does Pharaoh think the people have too much of? Too much time on their hands, right? Well, if they can take, if all they're sitting around doing is thinking about taking off out into the wilderness, I'm not keeping them busy enough. So he says, we're going to make it harder on you. He told the taskmasters, verse 6, he said, don't give them straw to make brick like before. Something I had not thought about until I was studying this time. Egypt is not a land of trees. You know, you think about mostly Egypt is desert with a fertile strip right along the Nile River. Bricks, there are two ways of, you know, baking brick. You can put them in the kiln. You heat them with fire. It takes a lot of wood. Or you lay them out in the sun. And according to, you know, the source I was looking at, the sun baked bricks, the straw was much more important for it to make it hold together. And there are two words here. He talks about straw and stubble. The straw wouldn't be pine straw, but, you know, you cut the wheat, the barley, other grains, and you've got these long stalks that are left. And what's down at the ground? The stubble. And they are told, we're not going to provide you the straw anymore. You have to go out and hunt it yourself. Before, you know, they're mixing the mud, mixing the straw. No, they've got to go and scrounge for it. And he says to them in verse 13, you've got to keep your daily quota. He adds work, but doesn't reduce the amount they're required. And the officers, verse 14 of Israel, they're like, you know, what's going on here? And they went to Pharaoh and they protested to Pharaoh. And they said, you know, we're getting beaten because we're not getting the work out of our people. And Pharaoh looked at verse 17. You are idle, idle. Therefore, you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. Therefore, go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks. And you watch for this understatement. And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it was said, you shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota. You think? They knew, oh, this is bad. This is not good. Look at 20 and 21. Do you get this picture? Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron who stood there to meet them. You see, do you get this picture of these officers have gone in? The people that are over, these are Israelites who are over their own people, you know, the taskmasters, the foremen. And Moses and Aaron don't go in with them. But they're outside anxiously awaiting what'll happen. And here they come out, and these men looked at Moses and Aaron. Now remember, end of chapter 4, the people bowed their heads and worshiped. Now they said, let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us. And Moses doesn't protest to them. He turns and he protests to God. Moses was a lot like people, you know. It took him a while. I mean, he was reluctant to take on the job. And as he takes on the job, God tells him, look, he's not going to let you go. You're going to go in and say, let my people go. It's not going to happen. And in fact, he had even said, he won't let my firstborn go unless maybe his firstborn dies. Chapter 4. I'll kill your son, your firstborn. So, you know, Moses turns to the Lord in verse 22 and says, Lord, why have you brought trouble on this people? Why is it you have sent me? For since I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has done evil to this people. Neither have you delivered your people at all. He's questioning God right here. He doesn't understand. The long-suffering of God is evident, though. Because God is patient with him. Look what he says. You will see, verse 1, what I will do to Pharaoh. With a strong hand, he will let them go. With a strong hand, he will, you know, the day is coming. He won't just let you go. He will shove you out the door. You know, it's in essence what he's saying. You're not going, you know, he's going to get rid. He said, look, Moses, I'm the Lord. It's kind of like saying, verse 2, remember the burning bush. I appeared to you there. I told you I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I made a covenant with them, verse 4. I would give them that. I would give them that land. And he says, I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel. Verse 5, I've remembered my covenant. Say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. I will rescue you from their bondage, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. I will take you as my people, and I will be your God. Then you shall know that I am the Lord your God, who brings you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will bring you into the land which I swore to give to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you as a heritage. I am the Lord. Look at what all he says here. He said, I hear what's going on. I've made a promise to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm going to keep that. And he says, judgments are coming. When we think of the plagues on Egypt, there really is multi-purpose for them. They are judgments on a nation who has done evil. They've oppressed God's people. But they are also intended to be instructional. Verse 7, after he is mentioned in verse 6, the outstretched arm, the great judgments, he said, then you shall know that I am the Lord. The Hebrews, the Israelites, needed their faith to be strengthened. They needed to know who the Lord was. Look at chapter 7, verse 5. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the children of Israel from among them. This all starts with the question, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? Who is this Yahweh of whom you speak? the Lord says, Moses, I know what's going on. I see the oppression of my people, and I'm about to act. And by the time I'm finished, your fellow Israelites will know who the Lord is. The Egyptians will know who the Lord is. Now, Moses was told, you go back and tell this to the people. And he goes back and he tells the people. And their response is not, okay, sounds good to us. Look at verse 9. So Moses spoke thus to the children of Israel, but they did not heed Moses because of anguish of spirit and cruel bondage. The English Standard says their broken spirit and harsh slavery, but I really, that spirit, broken spirit. They're struggling right now. They can't rise up to faith yet. They will, but not yet. Steve? I'm not sure of that. It is interesting to think about. I'd have to do a little more reading on that. I'm saying that because in the back of my mind, I'm thinking that some have questioned those reports. You know that whether that, you know, sometimes people say things and then turns out, well, it really wasn't. Y'all ever heard of fake news? I don't have any doubt that this happened, but the changing to stubble, I don't think lasts very long, because they're going to come out of this within the year. You know, this is not going to be a long process. We're not told how long the plagues took, but think about, we're told that Moses, in just a moment, how old is he as he stands before Pharaoh? He's 80. How old is he when he dies? He's 120. How long is he in the wilderness with the Egyptians? He's 40 years. So all the next little bit is going to happen pretty quickly. There's not going to be much of a break in all of this. So it happens rapidly. But look at Moses again. Moses is again at verse 12, Pharaoh's not going to listen to me. I'm a man of uncircumcised lips. And then, when you're reading along, you go, wait a minute, where did this come from? Because suddenly, the narrative, I mean, you could read from verse 13 and jump straight over to verse 28, and it make perfect sense. But Moses, as the writer, inserts, you know, we might would have put this in a modern writing style. We might have put this in a footnote or an appendix at the end of the chapter. But then again, maybe not. Think about the fact that when these things are first written, there would be very limited copies. You know, people didn't possess most of the time their own copy. It's delivered orally. I think that accounts for a certain amount of the repetition that you will see sometimes in the accounts, that a story will be told and then it'll back up and maybe it'll repeat some details, and we think that's not necessary. Well, no, because we can flip back a page. You know, it tells us about some guy. It's easy for me, just flip back a page. But when you're reading and you're just having to listen. And so I think most likely the idea is, let's just pause and let's make sure we understand who Moses and Aaron are. And he starts it off by saying, first of all, there was a son named Reuben. And he gives, children. And then there was a son named Simeon. Now, how many sons are there? 12, but he only gets to the third one. Because that's the one that matters to this. He comes to the third in order. And look at verse 16. This is one of those, Moses is planting the seed for the future. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Those things don't matter one bit in the book of Exodus, but they become very important in Leviticus. But he's going to hit, he lets us know they're going to be the three families. And he gives us a little bit about Gershon, Merari, not much. But the key one is Kohath. Because Kohath had some sons, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, Uzziel. And Amram, who does he marry? Jochebed. And they have three children that we know about, right? They have a daughter. And then they have the two sons. They have Aaron and Moses. He also tells us a little bit about the sons of Izhar. Korah, Nepheg, Zichri. Why does he tell us about Korah? What does Korah do in number 16? He rebels. And do you remember his question? Who are you? Moses, why are you and Aaron lording it over us? I can't say with certainty, but I think one of the reasons this genealogy is put right here is so that we can understand when we get down to Korah, a prophet is not without honor except in his own country and among his own people. Korah and Moses, they're not just distant kin as, well, we're all Israelites. They're both descendants of Levi. They're cousins. And maybe that helps us understand why Korah is like, we came from the same bloodline, pretty much. Why you, not me? And you think, of all the jobs, anybody want Moses' job? Moses didn't want Moses' job, And yet, there's Korah. But see, that little seed is planted for us here. And even kind of giving us some future. Aaron tells about his wife. Interesting, his wife is the sister of Nahshon. Who is Nahshon? Anybody? No? She must be important. He is the prince of Judah. When they go to the armies are marching out of Judah, he is the leader of Judah. So while Moses had married a Midianite, Aaron had married a woman of the tribe of Judah from a very prominent family. And they had four sons, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Won't be that long before we'll be reading about the bad end of two of those, right? And Eleazar, he ends up having a son named Phinehas. Phinehas doesn't become important to the story until we get way over in Numbers, chapter 25. At the end of the wandering in the wilderness. But he goes ahead, he's bringing him in. He's wanting us to understand as we go through this book. It's kind of a first, it's a review. This is who Moses and Aaron are. And then he's telling us about some people. It's kind of like, you're going to want to remember some of these names. Nadab and Abihu, and Eleazar and Ithamar and Phinehas. Those folks are going to be important, but it'll be later on. And so then he's back to the narrative. And Aaron, the Lord spoke to Moses, "You go speak to Pharaoh all that I say." And again, Moses protests, verse 30, "I'm of uncircumcised lips. How shall Pharaoh heed me?" And so he says to him, "I have made you as God to Pharaoh, and Aaron your brother shall be your prophet." As God to Pharaoh. Aaron is the spokesman. That means he's like the prophet. Moses says, "I'm of uncircumcised lips." He said, "Let me tell you something, Moses. When you stand before Pharaoh, you're not going to be there as the subordinate. You may not think it, but you are the superior." And what we see is from this point forward, Moses just plows ahead. You know, his faith is growing. He said, "Moses, I'm sending you in as a superior." Now he warns him again, "Pharaoh's not going to let you go. I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And what that will allow me to do is multiply my signs and my wonders. And I'm going to bring my people out," verse 4. "But it'll be by great judgments. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord." They're going to learn. And he said, "You just hang in there." And so, look at verse 6. "Then Moses and Aaron did so, just as the Lord commanded them, so they did." Moses, I mean, not to say that he's perfect from this point forward, but it seems as though he's reached his point now. He's ready. I real quickly, I want to show you this stick. I'm not going to do that tonight. I have the power, but no, not at all. Later on, what's going to happen with the rod of Aaron? Do y'all remember? Where will it be kept? Let me ask you that. You know, and some have said, you know, and in fact, I've thought this, well, could it really be kept in the ark, or did it mean maybe beside the ark? And I got, if the staff, and if y'all can see the piece of tape, if this stick were that long, it could fit inside the Ark of the Covenant. The average Pharaoh in Egypt was only 5 feet 6 inches tall. You know, they wouldn't have needed a stick as long as this one. A staff that long would have worked just fine. You know, so, you know, that's maybe unimportant, but when we read about it, you know, you think, well, could they really put the stick? Yeah. A good stick, walking stick for a man back in those days would have easily fit inside there. But he comes in and he says, this time, and I've wondered why they didn't do the miracle the first time, but I know it was all in the providence of God, the plan. So Aaron takes that rod and he throws it down. And can you imagine the jump back as it becomes a serpent? And Pharaoh, he calls for wise men. Well, they did in like manner with their enchantments. They threw down their rod and it became serpents. Great question is, did the, you know, satanic powers allow them to perform some actual sign? Or Bob Waldron says in his book that there are records in which the Egyptian magicians claim that they could charm snakes to make them look like a stick. You know, I kind of lean that direction. But what does Aaron's rod do to show that who was boss? It just ate them up. You know, can you? I mean, you just imagine this scene. That Aaron comes in and he's got, you know, he comes in and, I mean, he's an 83-year-old man. Yeah, he's coming in and, you know, he's got his walking stick. And all of a sudden he picks that thing up and he throws it down and it turns into a snake. Everybody's like, you know, the Egyptians. And notice what it says. They did it with their enchantments. They did their hocus pocus. And so suddenly we've got a bunch of little snakes running around. And then the big boy acts, and he just starts swallowing up snakes. You know, that would have been some scene, wouldn't it? That should have registered with Pharaoh, but it doesn't. Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them as the Lord had said. Over and over again, the Lord has said, he's not going to just let you waltz out of here. They're going to have to be these judgments. But also want you to take note. Verse 3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. Verse 13, Pharaoh's heart grew hard. Later it'll say Pharaoh hardened his own heart. God did not force Pharaoh's heart to be hardened. But he knew Pharaoh. He knew what kind of man he was. And he put before him the kind of things that would cause him to just harden his heart. Brother Paul. Yeah.
But a man that didn't want it took the Lord working of Pharaoh.
All right. And to jump ahead, the magicians will in some way imitate the water to blood. And they'll imitate the frogs. And when it gets to the lice, they said to Pharaoh, this is the finger of God. They are the first ones to say to him, maybe you ought to start paying attention here. He doesn't. If I can get this in real quick before the bell rings. Pay attention to the miracle of the plagues. 1, 4, and 7. It'll all make reference to being in the morning. 2, 5, and 8. It'll talk about them going into Pharaoh. And then 3, 6, and 9, there's really no warning given. It's an interesting pattern there. There's mourning, there's meeting with, you know, maybe in his palace, wherever, and then there's no warning. Okay.